Hey there, podcast listeners. This is Justin with a quick note before today's episode. I would love to start featuring you on the show. At beyondtheuniform.io, you'll see an option to share your story and your advice. Each week, I'm going to start adding these little snippets at the end of the show so that more people can share their advice and thoughts on how veterans can best succeed in their civilian career. So take a second, record your advice, and I look forward to hearing from you. Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Nasiri, and each week I interview military veterans about their civilian career. Today's episode number 95 with Andrew Watts.
Because I wrote two books before I decided to leave my job and do this full time. You've got to have a steady source of income, you've got to have savings, and you've got to have a clear path to getting to profitable replacement income for where you were. There's no kind of get rich quick path to self-publishing. And I definitely think you need to have a list of products that are already out there and kind of a proven track record before you start doing it as a full-time job.
Well, you are in for a treat today. My guest today, Andrew Watts, has not only worked at Procter & Gamble straight out of the military, but he's also now a full-time author of two books, soon to be three, starting next week. A couple things I think that you'll like about this interview. First of all, operations. So Andrew went into operations at Procter & Gamble because he did operations in the military, and he found out that they are very, very different. So he talks about the differences between the two and why you might like operations in the civilian sector. Second of all, Procter & Gamble. They love veterans, and they're a great signal for employers. If you have a company like P&G on your resume, it bodes very, very well. In fact, Andrew started getting recruiting calls the first week he was working at Procter & Gamble. So he gives a great overview of P&G, what their interview process is like, and how to prepare for interviews like that. Third of all, side projects. So what I love about Andrew's story is he did not jump straight into being an author. While he was working, he published his first two books. So that was Nights and Weekends. And he talks about why that's so important and how he did it. And then lastly, and most importantly, he's the first guest I've had on the show who is a full-time published author. He talks about the world of self-publishing, all sorts of different resources you can take advantage of to publish your books, and advice and thoughts on how you can succeed in this career path. As always, at beyondtheuniform.io, you'll find show notes. We talk a lot about different books and resources today. There's links there. Just a quick plug, if you do end up purchasing a book, or if you do a book on Audible, if you do click on the link on the Beyond the Uniform site, we get a couple cents for each of those. It's not a lot, but it helps to somewhat offset the cost of production. So we'd greatly appreciate that. And with that, let's dive in to my interview with Andrew Watts. Well, joining me today in Cincinnati, Kentucky is Andrew Watts. Andrew, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Hey, thanks, Justin. Thanks for having me.
So for listeners, quick background on Andrew. He is the author of three books, The War Planners, The War Stage, and Pawns of the Pacific. He started out at the Naval Academy in 2003 and served as a naval officer and helicopter pilot until 2013. He started his civilian career at Procter & Gamble for nearly 4 years, first as an assistant brand manager and then as an initiative operations leader. He published his first two books while at Procter & Gamble before making the transition to full-time author in 2017. So, Andrew, I'd love to start off by learning, how would you explain what you do for a living right now?
Sure. Well, I would say that I write and sell books. The emphasis is probably on the word sell. I spend at least as much time marketing and selling my books as I do actually creating the product. That's about what I'd sell. Usually the next question I get is, does your wife work? And I say yes, and then they say, okay, I understand now, you know. But that's what I do. That's what I say.
I'm just curious on that. Do you think for a veteran listening who's an aspiring author, how essential is it to have some other source of income, be that family wealth or a spouse that's working or significant savings? How vital is that?
I think it's crucial. So you'd spoken to me a little bit about the types of things that we would discuss. And I think one of the things that that triggered for me was, you know, what advice would I have for somebody else, you know, that, that might be considering this? And I would say, because I wrote two books before I decided to leave my job and do this full time. And I think you've got to have either, you know, a spouse. Well, you've got to have kind of all of it. In our case, we have multiple things, but you've got to have a source of income, steady source of income. You've got to have savings, and you've got to have a clear path to getting to, you know, profitable replacement income for where you were. So, yeah, I think it's not an easy, you know, there's no kind of get rich quick path to self-publishing. And I definitely think you need to have a list of products that are already out there and kind of a proven track record before you start doing it as a full-time job.
I have so many questions along that line, but let me just back up first and take us through how you decided to leave the Navy.
Sure. So it was 2013 when I got out. I think, I mean, we must have decided the year prior, but I was a flight instructor for my kind of middle assignment. I started off at HSO 46 out of Mayport, Florida. I then went and was a flight instructor down in Pensacola, Florida. So I was teaching Navy, Marine Corps, and Coast Guard student pilots how to become helicopter pilots. And then my last assignment, which was, you know, 2012 to 2013, was on the USS Enterprise. So it was on an aircraft carrier. And we were pregnant with our second child. So my daughter, our second child, was born 2 weeks prior to my deployment, and I was gone about 10 months out of that year. So you know, when I came back, my daughter was 8 months old. My son was almost 3 years old. And we were just, you know, we were getting to that point in our lives where we were having kids, and it was getting harder and harder to do those long deployments. And I know so many military families understand that, that tough period, you know, when you're having kids, and having to manage all those deployments. So for us, that was kind of the main reason. We just wanted to be able to see each other more often as a family. And the other piece of that was that while I was a flight instructor, I got my MBA at the University of Florida, and I really enjoyed a lot of the business-based classes that I took. So I wanted to try something in the business world, to hopefully one day, you know, run my own business or own my own business.
And I believe you had about 3 months between ending active duty and going on to PNG. What led you to Procter & Gamble? How did you end up going there?
Sure. I don't think, you know, I think 3 months is probably maybe average. I'm not really sure. But for me, that was about as long, that was about as quick as I could do it. I spent all three of those months interviewing with a zillion different companies and going to different career fairs and doing phone interviews and preparing. I mean, finding a job out of the military is in itself, I think, a full-time job. So I looked at a lot of different types of work. I think, you know, one of the roles that I was kind of drawn to at first was operations manager. And I think coming out of the military, I worked in operations, which the word operations in the military is something totally different than in the private sector. So I think, hey, they have the same, you know, it's the same word, so it must be the same thing. I think I kind of had that idea. But once I, you know, found out what it actually entailed in the private sector, I think I had a lot of training and education just in learning about what types of functions are out there in private sector jobs.
Well, let me just interrupt you there for a second. How would you explain for someone listening, like what does operations at Procter & Gamble or more broadly in the civilian sector, what does operations mean to you?
Yeah. So, you know, in the Navy, I think operations is, you know, whatever your unit is currently doing. So it might be, you know, it might be a flight schedule, or, you know, it might be unit movements, mobility through a certain area, and any type of operations that your military unit is conducting. However, for PNG, I would say operations management is more of a Excel-based scheduling, you know, working with supply chain and project management, program management type function. And it is, I think, a lot, you know, whereas I thought that it was kind of like a program manager, project manager, I thought that was kind of the person in charge. I think depending on what type of company you go into, they have different functions that are usually groomed for the executive roles. So at Coca-Cola, for instance, you know, where there's one or two main brands in their suite of products, they are very risk averse. They usually put a finance expert in charge of their company, and all their executives are made up of finance type people. In consumer product goods companies that have a larger group of products, like a Unilever or a Procter & Gamble, the brands, their suite of brands, are really what make the company. It's really what sets them apart from your generic, you know, store brand. So in order to succeed, you have to have experts in marketing and brand management. And so I think, you know, getting back to your original question, that's what drew me in to the brand management role at Procter & Gamble, is when I did go to those career fairs and I started to learn about the brand management career path, particularly in large consumer product goods companies. It was that leadership role that I craved. Coming, you know, being an officer in the military for about 10 years and wanting to groom myself for potential business ownership someday, I saw that as the best path to get there, being an ABM at Procter & Gamble.
And was it through a career fair that you found Procter & Gamble?
Yes, the Service Academy Career Conference, so it's open to graduates of service academies, was the conference that I attended, and I found out about P&G. I shouldn't say found out about it. That's where I first contacted them about the job, and that's what led me to the interview process. However, my wife will yell at me if I don't mention this. She grew up a mile away from Procter & Gamble's largest North America plant, which is in the Poconos in Pennsylvania. It's in Tunkhannock, Pennsylvania, in the town of Mehoopany. So she had grown up with P&G folks. It's a very small town. I think there was one, you know, red light in her town. And she grew up with a ton of P&G folks because they've got thousands of people at that plant. And she'd been telling me, you know, since I'd known her in the year 2000, that they loved military folks. They love ex-military folks because they know that they work hard, they're disciplined, and they are great performers. So P&G goes out of its way to hire military veterans. And they've got a great network of military veterans in their company. So when I went there, you know, my wife called me before I went to the career fair, and she made sure that I would visit the P&G, you know, tent. And I kind of rolled my eyes and said, okay, you know, sure. And then I went and talked to them, and I'm like, wow, this job sounds awesome. You know, I really want to do this. And so it worked out.
It's funny because when I first started Storybox, one of my advisors had told me, he said, look, if you can do a case study, if you can work with Procter & Gamble and have them as a client for Storybox and do a case study, every brand will want to work with you because every brand respects P&G, and they're just such a trendsetter within mm-hmm. the world of marketing. And I imagine the same is also true when it comes to resume fodder, when it comes to having some branding on someone's resume. I think Procter & Gamble is such a well-known, such a well-respected brand. It seems like a great spot to start one's career because it really puts that stamp of approval on you in addition to the military. And I imagine opens up a lot of doors if you had continued, you know, climbing the corporate ladder.
So I was at P&G for about a week before I started getting headhunters calling me to try and move me to a new company in the ABM role. And even when I switched functions into supply chain management, and I made sure to put that on my LinkedIn profile so I would stop getting all the calls, I still got marketing calls. I didn't get any calls about being a supply chain manager, but I got calls about being an ABM. So yes, I do think, you know, there's about 100,000 people in P&G. I think I'm guessing it's, you know, between 80 and 120, I think, but around 100,000 people in the company. And they hire about 50 people to go into brand management a year. So, and something like 95% of all their vice presidents and above are from the marketing function. So it really is a great place to be, and they've got great training. I think, you know, I'd like to think that I have used a lot of the knowledge and training that I gained in the brand management role at Procter & Gamble to help me develop, a product as I went into self-publishing.
That's great. I mean, I think that P&G probably falls into the category. I think with education institutions and really well-respected brands, there's a powerful signaling factor, and people assume, like, look, if this person made it through the rigorous screening process at a place like Procter & Gamble, then it's signaling that they're pretty high caliber. And so it's no surprise that even just a few weeks in, you start to get those recruiting calls. And I was curious, for someone listening who might be interested in a company like Procter & Gamble, what was the interview process like?
So it starts off with a written test, and it's online. So it's about an hour long, and it kind of reminds me of the SATs, except they're shaped some puzzles, and it's more of an IQ test. So I am assuming that the grading mechanism was broken the week that I took it, because I passed that. But once you pass the IQ test, then you move on to a phone interview. It's about an hour long. And the really neat thing about the phone interview was that, and I am assuming it was because I went in through the Service Academy Career Conference and I had a veteran recruiter, was that they hooked me up with a veteran interviewer within the marketing function. So it was a former West Point grad and a helicopter pilot who was doing my phone interview.
That's great. He kind of understands your background a little bit more. You don't have to explain as much.
Exactly. So after that, assuming you pass the phone interview, they would then invite you to an on-site in Cincinnati, assuming that that's where your job would be located. They have a variety of locations around the world, but a lot of the jobs are in Cincinnati because that's where the headquarters is. But they took me out to dinner the night before. I think I met up with another veteran assistant brand manager that had been hired a couple years prior. And he was a West Point grad, also a helicopter pilot. And we went out to eat. He told me about the job, very candid, answered any question I wanted to know. And then the next day I went, and you actually have to take an on-site written test to make sure that it's you. and then you do kind of a multi-person interview again for about an hour. And all the question, both the phone interview and the in-person interview, are kind of what I grew used to throughout interviewing with a lot of different companies, but it was that scenario based, you hear the STAR format or CAR format, the context action result. So they ask you, tell me about a time that you led a team through a crisis or whatnot. And then, you kind of tell a story. So I think one of the things that I was good at was telling stories. And I had a few good stories to tell, from my experiences in the military. I think that's typically one area that military veterans can excel in an interview process, if you're able to use the, probably really awesome stories that you have from your experience in the military. You kind of have a leg up on your civilian competition for a job. But I went through that interview, and those are non-veterans, but they were within the marketing function for me. And I think there were three of them. That was an hour long. And they told me right after that, normally you might wait a week or so, but they told me right after that, one of the HR reps brought me into a room and told me that I was going to get hired, and that, they were going to make me an offer, and they were just putting that together. And I think I did, pretty much everything wrong. I didn't even wait for him to tell me how much money it was going to be. I just said, yes, I accept the job,
What would you have done differently? Would you have just kind of, asked for those details and asked for time?
I think you're supposed to. I mean, the advice I would give someone is that you should do it like you're playing poker. Keep calm, wait until you get everything in writing, and then make your decision. Make sure you have all your options available. You don't want to have some company lowball you. I don't think an established company like P&G would ever, try and lowball someone. I don't think they even negotiate at P&G. I think they just have a number, that they give to all ABMs, or, and maybe they scale it based on education and certain other things on your resume. But I am, to my detriment, too honest, I think, and I always have been. So yeah, I was just like, huge smile on my face, like, yes, I accept. Oh, you didn't give me the salary yet. Okay.
You're like, that's way more than anyone else was offering me.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, in the almost 4 years you were there, you were an assistant brand manager and then the initiative operations leader. For someone on active duty who might be listening, how would you explain those roles and just kind of a sense of the types of things you did in that capacity?
Sure. Well, the brand management role was kind of unique. So normally, if you're an assistant brand manager, that's the entry-level job in a consumer product goods company for marketing. And like I said, the marketing job at those companies, they kind of run the business. So normally you're assigned to a business. And when I say business, I mean like a brand like Cascade dish soap or Tide laundry detergent. And you would help to ship cases and manage advertising agencies that help to create digital advertising and go over strategy, pricing strategies, new product development. What I did was a little bit unique. So I was, you know, of the 50 or so people that were hired for North America the year that I went in, I went into what was called new business creation, and they've since changed the name. They've rebranded it, but it was basically new product development. So the section I was in, I think at the time I was the only ABM in this, you know, organization of about 70 people. And our mission was to develop the next billion-dollar brands that P&G was going to invest in. So we had, you know, maybe a portfolio of about 10 to 20 different products that we were working on developing. So we had a lot of R&D folks in that organization. We had design folks. We had finance people and consumer market researchers. So those are the kind of people that do, you know, consumer research and interview consumers and ask them about what they like about a product and whatnot. And I worked with all those functions and also helped to manage the advertising agencies as we developed these new products. That was a really neat job. I got to travel around the country and even around the world in some cases as we, you know, worked on designing and creating new products. I helped to create TV commercials and email marketing campaigns and interview consumers and go into people's homes and, you know, do a lot of kind of behind two-way mirrors, listening to focus groups and whatnot in order to develop like the right messaging and concepts for these products. But that was, it was a lot of fun. I learned a ton. And one other thing I should mention, in as you go into some of these real solid companies that have roles that they're known for, like the marketing jobs at P&G, they have a great training program. So I was able to go to, you know, multi-week courses on how to create advertising copy, how to critique advertising copy, and you know, just learn a ton about marketing, digital advertising, and whatnot. So that was really beneficial to me again as I started to kind of do something for myself while I was working there.
Yeah, I just yesterday spoke to a friend of mine, sibling, who's a non-traditional student at an MBA program, and she was just asking advice on how to prepare for that career transition. And that was one of the things that stood out when I was speaking with her, is the advantage of going to an established company, because they do have a great training program. They do have a great regimen. And I think that, you know, even though a lot of us are cynical about the military, when you think of it as a massive organization capable of constantly preparing people for a diverse set of tasks, they do have a fairly good training program. And I think that a company like P&G is very, very similar in that they can really take you and teach you everything you need to know. And the great thing from with a company like P&G is you're learning from the best. And when I contrast that to starting your own company, which has been my experience, or joining an early stage startup, you don't really, it's more of like kind of throw someone in the deep end, have them figure it out on their own, reinvent the wheel, just kind of constantly trying to figure things out. I can see in retrospect the advantage to going through a program like that, where you're being mentored and taught and trained in a very tried and true method.
Absolutely.
And what was the lifestyle like for you? What's the, I'm wondering how much, you know, were you working weekends and nights, and on average, what did that look like?
Yeah. So, again, I had two different jobs. So at first I had the marketing job and then I had the supply chain management job. And I can talk about why I chose to do that, but I would say
why is that actually? I think that would be curious.
It was actually for the writing. So I naively thought that if I went into a supply chain role, I would be able to leave at 4 o'clock every day and have all this extra time to write my books and everything. And that was just, it's laughable that I thought that was the case. I worked just as hard, and you know, the hours were pretty similar, although it was a little bit more flexible because I started having some work from home days. But yeah, that was the reasoning. You know, I thought that, it was going to be a little bit lower, kind of lower pressure, and a little bit more flexible, to allow me to do something on the side. But it, you know, and we can talk about this later if you want, but once I realized that, you know, I think the supply chain management job taught me, if you're going to sell a lot, you have to have a lot of capacity in your factory. And being a writer, my capacity is my time to write. And I needed to do that full time so I could get as many books out as possible in as short a time as possible. But back to what you were asking about. Well,
one thing I was just going to say on that. Yeah. So I had earlier on the show an author, Cal Newport. He's not a veteran, but he wrote a book called So Good They Can't Ignore You, which I would recommend to anyone. And I just finished his second or his most recent book called Deep Work. Have you read that book out of curiosity?
I haven't, no.
It is I'm like violating podcasting rule 101. I have no idea where that phone is though. Sorry about that. what he talks about in his book, I recommend it to any listener. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. But in Deep Work, he just talks about the importance of how for most of us right now, we have this superficial work style where we're constantly checking email and constantly checking news and Reddit and different things that pulls us out of what really matters. And that the most profound and quality work we produce is from intense, uninterrupted times.
Yes.
And it gives so many practical ways to do this. And it has been so revolutionary for me when I'm working on Storybox stuff, just applying his lessons learned from that. And so when you were speaking about that, I can only imagine, and we'll get into this, but I can only imagine juggling a full-time job, kids and a family, and writing. Like it's, I can only imagine how difficult it would be to actually move the ball forward in writing.
Yeah, I think so. That was part of it. I was probably slightly going crazy, and that was maybe one of the reasons that I decided to switch. I was willing to try anything, because I had just written one book and I was working on the second, and at that time we had 3 kids under 5 years old, and you know I had roughly a new job. I was newly out of the military and maybe a year to 2 years in to the marketing job. I think I did that for a little over 2 years. But yeah, it was really tough, to do it all at once and write books. When I was a flight instructor, I got my MBA and we had our first child, and I thought that was really hard. It was extremely hard trying to write a book and doing all that. But I think that that's kind of what you have to do. At least for me is to my level of risk aversion. I think that's what you have to do because it's impossible to. It would have been impossible for me to learn and experiment and honestly to spend money as freely as I wanted to on advertising and building a website and trying out all these different things and be able to learn as quickly as I was able to with the safety net of having a full-time job that I could, lean back on.
And have you ever read Big Magic by Elizabeth Gilbert?
No, please don't ask me if I've read any more books because I feel really bad now.
No, I have. These are just the few I have up my sleeve. But okay. I would recommend that to any listener. So Elizabeth Gilbert, she wrote Eat, Pray, Love. Your significant other has probably read it. You probably haven't. I haven't read it. But she wrote this great book. It's one of the few books that I've I did the audiobook, but I listened to it. But I've listened to it multiple times, which I haven't done for any other book ever. And it's just basically about the creative process, whether you're in startups or whether you're writing. And one of the things that she says that you're making me think of is – she says she always cringes when someone comes up to her and says, "Oh, I'm going to quit my job and I'm going to start writing, and I've never wrote before." And she talks about that only after she wrote multiple books, but only after the success of Eat, Pray, Love, which is like number one New York Times bestseller, only then did she actually quit her job, because she talks about like don't put pressure on your inspiration, like to add so much pressure on yourself when you've never written anything, that then to learn all of that and ask of your art and your inspiration to also supply you with a living wage. It's just a lot. And so she talks about the value of setting aside that time in the morning and late at night and showing and proving to yourself that you really do want to do this. And she almost makes it a conversation with this inspiration force of like showing inspiration that you're showing up in those early hours. And I wanted to learn about what was your process. You know, I'd love to learn about what your process was in writing while having a full-time job, and any advice you have to anyone listening who might be working somewhere and want to start writing, and how they might go about that.
Well, I would say the first bit is you've got to have a really good partner. Because I think I owe a lot to my, I know I owe a lot to my wife, and I wouldn't have been able to do it if she wasn't on board and helpful and supportive. So while I was working, you know, work obviously came first. You asked about what the, you know, the kind of the lifestyle at P&G was like. When I first moved to the area in Cincinnati, I think we met up with one of our neighbors and we had a party, and they invited us over, and he heard I worked for P&G in the brand management role. And it's like, oh, wow, that's a great job. He's like, but, you know, you got to pedal hard. And I kind of heard that, and I wasn't expecting it from somebody that didn't work there. But it's true. Like it was kind of a really intense job at times, and a lot like the military in some ways. But you know, it was the kind of thing, you know, you get to work early, you're working hard all day, meeting after meeting after meeting, back to back to back. And then at night you're checking email and probably answering emails and sometimes doing work and sometimes working on weekends. You know, it's not like a, investment banking Wall Street job where you're working 18 hours. I had some of those in the military, but it's a very busy job. So I think, for me to write a book, and while we had, you know, young kids and everything, the challenge was, where do I find these extra hours? And, it was sleep. It was any free time that I possibly would have had to go to that. And then it was on the weekends, you know, where do I want to sacrifice, and how much pain is my wife willing to sacrifice so that I can do something that I am trying to kind of move forward, not only to help myself, you know, for a hobby. I think at some point over that, you know, first year, I realized like I could really see myself doing this long term. And after having conversations with my wife about that, you know, she was supportive, and we realized like, okay, you know, let's. Just like, you know, when I got an MBA, she was willing to help pick up the slack. Now she, Molly, my wife, has a job. She works from home and does contract work for the Kaiser Family Foundation and a few other clients, but she does healthcare policy work. So it was important that, you know, there is also income from her, and she was able to help us out that way when I made the transition to full time. Yeah, it was a give and take, and definitely a partnership. And I would stay up at night, you know, sometimes in bed, you know, after she went to sleep, and I'd be writing until midnight, and get like an hour and a half in there. If I could just get, you know, 500 to 1,000 words a day, I would be moving the football forward, you know, and any progress was helpful. But I think one of the things I did is I tried to use what I learned at P&G in how to develop a new product. So we have something at Procter & Gamble that they called a TLE, a transactional learning experiment. So it's basically like a test market, only it's a test market where you're actually selling something to people. So I thought the best way I could learn how to write books and how to self-publish was just write something short and put it out there and sell it and start selling it. And maybe people will hate it, maybe nobody will read it. But you know, at least I would get something out there. So I think that probably took me, you know, about 3 to 4 months to actually write a short story, a novella, and put it out on KDP, Amazon KDP, Kindle Direct Publishing, and just see what happens, you know? So it really was a learning process, kind of a hard process of balancing all the different parts of our lives. But I think, you know, if it's something you really want, everyone in the military has worked hard. So it was just a matter of, you know, gritting my teeth and doing it and finding the time and sacrificing any TV show or, you know, any personal time that I might have had. Sometimes sacrificing workouts, you know.
And for listeners at beyondtheuniform.io, I'll add in the show notes links to Kindle Direct Publishing and everything else that we're talking about. You know, one thing that makes me think of, Andrew, is, you know, another aspect of this book, Deep Work, is just the realization, I think we all know this intuitively, but when we have boundaries, we tend to work more efficiently. Mm-hmm. And I know that what you're doing took an immense amount of time, but I also know that, or I would imagine that, because you had this purpose, because you were like, look, it's my family, my job, my writing, I'm imagining you said no to a lot of fluff that wasn't necessary in your life. I imagine you worked to get things done more efficiently at work. I just think that there's also an advantage to having a vision like you had in writing your book and having that, you know, the thought of having something succinct that you would publish first, where it really gives you a milestone to sprint towards rather than just meandering like I can get into if I don't have a clear goal. So I really applaud you on being able to do that while working full time.
Yeah, thank you. And I think so. One example of what you're talking about of, you know, being forced to work more efficiently, I think any time that I could do two things at once, I did. So podcasts, audiobooks, you know, where I used to read fiction books, maybe on a Kindle or something, I then went to audiobooks and I would listen to that during my commute or working out, podcasts and nonfiction audiobooks to kind of help educate myself, anything that I could help teach myself something or learn that was going to help me get smarter on how to do self-publishing or advertising. I did that, you know, again, during times where I could do two things at once. Mm.
And, you know, I want to ask you a couple specific questions about the writing, but just for listeners, I know if you're like me, you kind of hear from people who have written books and you know, you look at Amazon and you see really positive reviews and there's very small numbers and you just assume that this is just the person's friends and family who have done them a favor. Andrew's gotten 4 stars and 399 reviews for his first book and 4.5 stars on Amazon, 157 reviews. This is like very, very impressive numbers. I forget the ratings. I looked it up on Goodreads as well. It's even better. And usually when I'm reading books, I read a lot. You know, I read a lot of 3.5 stars and 3.75. Once you get up in that four range with that number of reviews, you're dealing with a legitimately good book. And so I just wanted to call out before we get into the tactics of what Andrew has done, that he's really done something very rare in not only you know, becoming a self-published author, but doing it really well and doing high quality work. And so, Andrew, I wanted to ask about, like, how long, you know, so your first two books, I believe, were while you were still at Procter & Gamble. I'm just wondering, you know, having a full-time job, how long did it take for you to write your first book? And then how long did it take for that second book?
So, first of all, I should probably say, you know, you mentioned all the reviews I have. My mother has 700 Amazon accounts. So, you know, that can kind of account for some of that, but... No, but I think I mentioned I kind of created a short story first. So I think it took me about 3 or 4 months to write that first short story. And then I said, okay, I kind of got the hang of this. I was selling it at 99 cents. And then I decided, you know, I was working on the second one. I got that out as fast as possible. And then a lot of the negative reviews were it's too short or it ends on a cliffhanger. And so that was teaching me a couple things. One, it was teaching me that each type of book in each genre, they have specific rules that you have to follow in order to get good reviews, in order for people to be satisfied. So I realized, okay, I've got to write complete novels if I'm going to write in this kind of thriller genre or action adventure genre. I'm using Amazon subject category terms. So I started writing full novels and I forgot about these kind of novella, you know, piecing it together in a series, although I do write in a series. But I wrote full novels and it probably took me about 1 year to get out a novel. And the second novel, again, probably about a year, maybe a little bit shorter than that. But a lot of that time is, you know, now that I'm doing it full time, I'm aiming for one book every 3 to 4 months. And a lot of that time is not spent writing. It is spent doing editing or sending it out to my advanced review team, or giving it to beta readers, or working on the audiobook production. So there's a lot of different aspects to it that I might not be the one that is doing the active work. And so again, I talked about being more efficient. If there's the opportunity if someone else has the football and I can do something else, or someone else has the baton and I can do something else, then I'm going to start working on the next book, So I always want to be busy. I always want to be making myself busy so that I can get out as many books as possible, as fast as possible. Because in the world where I don't have this, amazing, big five publisher distribution where I'm on the shelves in every Barnes and Noble, as soon as you walk in the store, I have to play kind of a different game. I have to play a volume game and a lower pricing game. And I have to get my books in front of people, and then hopefully they like it enough that they'll keep buying more and more. And it's in my best interest to put out as much as possible, as often as possible. So it really behooves the self-published author until the industry changes again to do it that way, to kind of mass produce and rapidly produce.
How should veterans think about that decision between self-publishing versus working with a publisher?
I would say that in this day and age, I would not recommend even writing. I've never written a letter to an agent. I've never written a letter to a publisher. And I would recommend doing the same thing to anyone that's thinking about trying writing.
And is the main difference, it seems to me that the publisher brings to bear, or ostensibly they bring to bear, the power to get your book out there. Basically what they're bringing to the table is maybe some editing and review, but mostly the promotion. Is that right?
Yeah. So I guess, a publisher would potentially, depending on the investment they put behind you, they would be paying for the editing, but really it's distribution and marketing spend. So, one of the things I learned in my various jobs at P&G is the number one driver of sales for a product is distribution. So if you can get your book on the landing page of, Amazon Kindle, when you click on the, Kindle books, then you're just going to have an enormous amount of sales, just because you're going to get that book in front of so many people. If you are in the, the front shelf in Barnes and Noble, when you walk into the fiction section, you're going to have an enormous amount of sales. One of the things I worked on was volume forecasting when I was in marketing at P&G. And I would argue so much with this woman that I worked with about how much the people are going to like the TV commercial that I made. And it was humorous, because she was like, Andrew, it doesn't matter. Like, people, it matters a little bit. She showed me all the formulas and, that we use to forecast volume. And it matters a little bit, but not nearly as much as the number that we were going to plug in on our estimate for what the distribution would be, how many stores were going to hold us, how much shelf space we were going to get. If you can get something in front of someone, a certain percentage of people are going to buy it, almost no matter what. So now what you want to do is you want to get it in front of as many people as possible and improve the cover and the blurb so that you can increase your conversion rate as much as possible. Because that's going to be the difference between, being able to be successful and not. And part of that is the product good? And how many reviews do you have? And what is your average star rating for reviews?
When did you think of starting your own book? Like, have you always wanted to be an author? Or what did that come about?
So I read a lot. I mean, I remember in fifth grade reading Tom Clancy. I'd carry around these like huge, thick, The Hunt for Red October books. And as a fifth grader, and I think my Catholic school teacher looked at me disapprovingly, because there were curse words in it. But it was on my last deployment. I was on the USS Enterprise, and it was a really busy job. I mean, it was like painfully eyes bleeding busy at some points, but then about, 6 months into the deployment, there were times where we're sitting in the off the coast of Pakistan, basically. And we just, for me, as the air operations officer for the DESRON, I don't know if I need to explain that term, but it was not that busy at times. I had maybe 2 to 3 hours a day that I could figure out what I wanted to do for myself. And I worked out a lot, but I also decided, hey, you know what? I've always wanted to try this. I want to try writing. So I wrote about 50 pages on that deployment. And then I think I just shelled it when I came home and started looking for a real job. I looked at when I was looking for jobs, one of the types of jobs that I looked at was actually franchising. So I knew I craved owning my own business and running my own business. But I just, the capital investment for a franchise, giving away a lot of your revenue to somebody else that actually owns the franchise, that didn't appeal to me. So, I didn't think that there was any skill set that I had developed enough on my own that I could, you know, start my own business. So, my wife went to Princeton, she played field hockey there, and one of her good friends is writing a nonfiction book, and she had finished the book. She went away for the summer, wrote this book, and I happened to say, oh, you know, I wrote about 50 pages of this fiction book, when I was on the aircraft carrier on my deployment. And, she's like, you have 50 pages written? She's like, you should totally publish that, you know? And I was like, I don't know. And she's like, no, you should. And I was like, yeah, that's a good idea. And at the time, you know, I was probably going crazy because we had 3 kids under 5 and working a new job, making that transition out of the military. So I said, you know what, I want this a lot, and I dedicated myself to it. But yeah, I think it was just, it became a little bit of an obsession, a little bit of a hobby. And then eventually it became like, this is what I want to do.
There's so many different questions I want to ask, and I know we've only got about 5 to 10 minutes here. Maybe just briefly, for a veteran who's listening to this, who's thinking of a career as a writer, what resources would you recommend to them? Is there any particular book or website, courses, podcast, anything that you think they should check out?
So for learning how to write, Stephen King has a book called On Writing.
Such a good book. Yep.
Yeah. So I would recommend that one. I thought that was really good. And for self-publishing, there's The Creative Pen. So you can just search The Creative Pen. But there's a woman named Joanna Penn who is well-known in the self-publishing world for how to do it. She's tried everything. She left a six-figure consulting job, like a tech consulting job, you know, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, and just, you know, wanted to be an author. So she started doing that, and she kind of blogged about it. And now she's back making like double what she was making, because she's doing all the right things, and she's telling everyone how she's doing it. Mark Dawson is another good person to search. So he is a thriller writer. He's big on Amazon. He started self-publishing again, probably like 5 years ago, maybe. I think he's probably making 7 figures through writing, you know, thriller books and self-publishing those. But again, he's got like 20 books out. He was a former lawyer, but he creates courses and teaches people how to do Facebook ads, how to use email lists, and, you know, how to sell your books. He also, I think, has a starter course on like how to self-publish for beginners. So that would be a good one to look at.
This is great. I'm wondering, how do you structure your day, a typical day, especially, I think this applies to entrepreneurs and authors, where you have an open landscape. How do you structure your day, and any advice to aspiring authors about how to best stay on task?
Yeah, so I think you hit the nail on the head when you were talking about how you need uninterrupted time, because you're a lot more productive that way. So if I'm actually writing, writing the first draft, I have to have uninterrupted time where, you know, multiple hours. I might go in like hour spurts and then take a little break and then go back. But, if I'm kind of in the zone, then I can write, you know, 1,000 to 1,500 words per hour. But if I'm not, you know, if I'm being interrupted, or if, again, like you were saying, if I'm like checking the news or, you know, the NFL draft or something, you know, anything that can distract me, then that word count will just shoot down, and that really kills my productivity. The other thing that is hard, you know, I have to be disciplined about is not checking my sales too much or not checking my advertising, you know, ROI like throughout the day and see what, how many, what's my cost per click at that second, you know? So things like that, are, can be a distraction. So you really do have to tune out everything. And, to answer your question, so I, you know, we probably get up with the kids anywhere between 6 and 6:30, do some, you know, help the kids get ready, do all that house stuff. And then, I'm hoping to be back upstairs. So I have a little desk in my master bedroom. My wife has an office right next to, the master bedroom. So we work, like I joke around that she's my new office boss. So I work in my bedroom. I will, the first thing I usually do is check all my financial returns. So I'll look at what my sales were for the last 24 hours, what my advertising spends on various different, platforms that I'm using are, just kind of check all my results for the day before. And I've got a big, huge spreadsheet. I learned in my supply chain job, I learned how to use Excel pretty well. And I've got a huge spreadsheet that keeps track of everything. I break it down by profit per country, by profit per retailer, and make sure that I'm making smart advertising decisions. And I can always just stop advertising. That's an option too, if something's not working. So I kind of recap on, okay, where am I financially? And then I'll spend a couple hours writing and working on whatever project I'm working on, is whether it be editing, you know, revisions after I get it back from my editor, or if I'm in the middle of a first draft. And I just try and get up to certain word counts. If I can write 3,000 words a day, if I'm working on a first draft, I'm happy with that. That kind of keeps me on track to write about a book every 3 to 4 months. And I spend the afternoons doing, working with either cover designers or formatting books, or working with my email list. So I've got an email list of about, you know, 15, 16,000 people, and about 500 of them are my advanced review team. And then about 20 or 30 of them are my beta readers. So I use different kind of groups for different purposes to help develop the product. And then again, when I launch, you know, that advanced review team, you talked about reviews. There's different ways to get reviews, you know, and if you've got kind of a group of, you know, I hope they are, but quote unquote super fans, then, you know, they're there to, I can give them an advanced copy, and they're there to give at least a jump start on reviews. I might get, you know, I'm launching a book next week, and I'm hoping, you know, in that first week I'll get like 50 reviews right off the bat. You know, then when I do my hard launch, I'll email out all those 16,000 people. So, you know, I hope that I'll get like 1 or 2,000 sales in that first week, you know? So I think things like that will jumpstart your success. I will split up the rest of the day working on email marketing, Facebook ads. I use a few other platforms for advertising that I don't think we need to go into here, cause it's a little bit more in the weeds.
I'm just realizing as you say all this, like, it really is, you are a one man business. This is like, yes. This is everything you're describing is a small business that any it other is. Business has to do. And it's kind of like you're responsible for all of those. And I can imagine how challenging that would be, but also how fulfilling it would be to just be able to have complete creative license in every aspect of this.
It's awesome. I live by that creative license and I die by that creative license. So yeah. Hopefully I learn and make good decisions. But yeah, I mean, I've got a book cover designer in the UK, my formatter is in Australia, my editor's in Michigan. Like, I mean, the world is flat, you know, I read that one. So you can anybody can do this. It just takes a lot of work. And I would say that I think my military experience helps me with discipline, and it helps me with, you know, kind of fueling my creativity and knowing about the subject matter that I write about, and the marketing background I have, and even the supply chain background I have, helped me in various ways to know how to run the business. So I think if I hadn't had that education over the past 3 or 4 years, it would be a lot harder to run it successfully. And I'm just starting out. So, you know, I mentioned to you before the show, when we talked, I feel like I am one of your less successful stars that you've had on the show. I was blown away by some of them. I hope that I've done enough work, and I think I've seen enough evidence that if I continue along this path, it will be successful. And part of that is studying the competition. And I know that there are other people out there that are doing similar things that are achieving great success.
Awesome. Well, for listeners, you'll find links at beyonduniform.io for everything we discussed, but you can find Andrew as well at andrewwattsauthor.com. He's the author of two books out right now, The War Planners and The War Stage. And just shortly after you're first listening to this episode, Pawns of the Pacific, his latest book, will be released. So, Andrew, thank you very much for joining us. Thank you for all the advice on this.
Thank you, Justin.
Surface.
All right, veterans, a few other quick announcements before signing off. A reminder, at beyonduniform.com/your advice on the website, you'll be able to record your own thoughts, your advice for other listeners. I'll start posting those at the end of each episode. Second, if you're not part of our newsletter just yet, definitely sign up. That's the primary method I use for communicating. Third, audible.com. Thank you for sponsoring this episode. For listeners, if you go to beyonduniform.io/books, not only can you get a free audiobook from audible.com, absolutely free, no strings attached, but we also get a commission every time you sign up, regardless of whether or not you continue. That's one of the ways I'm trying to offset the cost of it's about $100 or $200 a month to keep the show going. So helping out there would greatly move the show forward. Lastly, every resource mentioned on the show today, all those books, all those resources, beyonduniform.io. Look at the show notes for Andrew, and you'll see everything you need to know there. Thanks. Have a great week, and keep the feedback coming.